As a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So, Tom, ready to hear what you got to say?
Thank you, everyone. My name is Tom Hoffman. I'm a real grateful alcoholic. I'll celebrate on July 4th, 47 years, so I've got a couple under my belt. All along here, I've used the 12 and 12 to inspire me, if you want to call it that. But my God in heaven, I ran into step 12 and the 12 and 12, and my goodness, it's a half a book. Jeepers creepers. So I wasn't 100% certain how I was going to handle this evening, but I thought maybe it might be wise just to go over everything and let you know where I ended up at the end. I'm the father of three great boys, the grandfather of eight grandsons, one granddaughter, and three great-grandsons. So I put a handle on everything I touched, so they're all okay. I've been married to my wife, it'll be 60 years this coming January, which doesn't seem any more possible than 47 and dry, but that's what it's going to be. And like a lot of couples, we had our ups and we had our downs. And I touch on them lightly, but she's a great lady, wonderful to me. I've spent the last 2 years in and out of the hospital with a lot of things. She insists that my son drive me here because I fell on the fell. So she watches every damn move I make and really gets to be annoying after a while. But she's real good to me, really is. But before we got into things, why I had not really drank until I got to be 21, and she had no idea what she was getting into. So I didn't. I had no idea what was going to go on. But it didn't take long for three boys to come along and other things of life that can make or break a man. And I came close to being broken, but didn't make it all the way. We had, as I said, some issues. But they're all patched up and we're on our limbering way. We're just moving along. But I thought I'd quickly go over a couple of things. Where admission came up that I was powerless over alcohol. That was kind of a sneaky thing for me, because my physician put me in the hospital, Hammett, Dr. Amaker, for a week, telling me I was going to have a physical. Well, here it was my wife pushing him to get me in the hospital because I had been drinking too damn much. But through that, I got introduced to a psychiatrist, and started some treatment through him. And after some talk back and forth, actually my introduction to him was an introduction. He looked at me, looked at my papers, and he's a psychiatrist. He says, "You did some damage to your liver." And I thought, whoa, we don't want to do that. But we went into I went into working with him and my medical doctor and trying hard to get things under control by myself. Paved hell a mile with the rosary, but it didn't all settle. So that rotten Times News every day had a column in it with the AA number and with a listing of every AA meeting in town. And I can't sometimes believe it, but it did come out like a flashing neon sign to me every time I opened the paper, whether it was on page 1 or page 10. It didn't seem to matter. It seemed that that was shining. So things were getting close. Things were getting tense at home. And I guess it's about in there that I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. Not quite admitting about the life being unmanageable, but got the first part down. Anyhow, at that point, why I felt it was necessary to pursue it a little bit further, because my life wasn't getting any better. Our home life wasn't getting any better. The kids were doing all right. They didn't have any idea. But it just wasn't improving. So I did make that call to that answering service. They've got it neat, had it neat 47 years ago, and I think it's just the same now. You get called, you get plugged into a man or a woman, whichever you are, they'll plug you into, and you'll be able to talk to that individual, which I did. Suddenly I was talking to Bob, who ended up my sponsor, and he said, "Why don't you come over to the house, we'll talk tomorrow." So I said, "Okay, we'll do that." Bob was, I don't know, in his 80s somewhere, had 30-some years at that time, or 20-some years, whatever he had. But I went over on that Saturday morning, and sat in front of Bob, and he told me his tale. He came from Summit Township, and when he was a kid, they came to Marvintown and do their shopping and all that stuff. But he talked for, easy an hour, and then gave me a chance. And I talked to him for an hour, too. But I did spill quite a few of my guts when I look back at all that. Coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity wasn't yet in the books, yet I was seeing a psychiatrist, so there must be something going on there. And my little mind does do logical things. So I there's always a fine line for me as to when this happened and when that happened. There was no bolt of lightning for coming to believe or anything like that. And that tells us that in the book. But for some reason, I think I should have some revelation or whatever it is. But it was that day that that I made the decision to pursue Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was in January of 1974. I wasn't a whiz kid, but I did catch on pretty fast. Bob and I talked, and he said, "Mind if I pick you up tomorrow?" And I said, "No." 4:30 the next day, he was out my front porch, or front driveway. And that was his way of handling a pigeon, or a sponsee, however you guys want. I was a pigeon back then. But he felt it was great to take a person to Wattsburg or Edinburgh or whatever, where you had a chance to talk, you had a chance afterwards, if you had a minute to stop and have a piece of pie and a cup of coffee. So that was kind of his method of salving my aches, whatever. But he came and picked me up. He had his girlfriend, Florence, in the back seat. And I wondered why that Saturday he didn't have me come right over, because that wasn't Bob's style to have me wait till the next day. But it was Florence interrupted things. But God love him, he loved her. But I went. I remember who spoke. It was Joe Case of Whiskey, Joe Kissel. Walked in the room. There was an old fat priest behind the counter. And then I saw my mother-in-law's insurance man, and my mother-in-law's boss. And it just blew the hell out of anonymity, and I knew it very well. She was very proud of me, so she wanted me to have the best of everything. Well, a guy named Jack worked with her, Jack Seib, and she asked me if I'd mind if I... She had him come along sometime. So we set up an arrangement, and between the three of us, my regular meeting became the Wednesday Night Young at Hearts group. And up until I got sick, it still was. And then we had this COVID stuff. At that time, well, not quite that time, just shortly after I came in, the 512 meeting was popping up. That was kind of a great thing, I thought. They had some thinking behind it that said, well, we'll have desserts that you have to use a fork with, and we'll have china cups so that you'll stay afterwards and wash dishes. Well, I think there was about two dishwashers out of many, many people. So that some of that stuff faded away. But my beginning program started that way, at the Wednesday night meeting. Bob, having been around as long as he was, introduced me to many, many, many men that are, they're gone now, but they were the cream of the crop, really. They were the guys you went down to the club and you saw sitting in the corner talking to somebody. And the club was a big part of my life when that happened. I had been separated from the wife and living with another alkie, and the two of us latched onto that club like it was going to run away or something. I don't know what it was, but it was our salvation. And I just stuck to it. My friend stuck to it and then had an issue and had come back. And he was back and forth for quite a while. And now he's got about, 20 years in. But that first 20 were hell. The poor guy, because when he went out, he went out. But it was during that time that I had the opportunity to look hard at myself and do that searching and fearless thing. And it wasn't something I just sat down and read or wrote or anything like that. It was more of a coming on to me, slowly but surely. And but there was a lot that came on. And fortunately for me, I was talking to Bob every night, every evening. And he'd give me hell and all that stuff. And then we'd straighten it back out. But it was a great part of my sobriety, and it really brought things out of me that I didn't realize were there. Through that all, my faith began to build a little bit better. I was working out of town, and I wanted to work back home. I left on Monday, come back on Friday. It was tremendous. Saw the same damn flowers in motels everywhere. That picture's just there. Anyhow, where the hell was I? Oh, I wanted this job back home. I wanted anything back home. I was working for a retail drug outlet, remodeling their stores, and I'd go in on a Monday when this first started. I'd have 15 people working for me, a plumber, a carpenter, and an electrician, and I'd take the store apart and put it back together in about 4 to 6 week time. It was a great job, and I loved it. I loved what I did, but I was away from home constantly. My boys grew up almost without a dad, and so Monsignor Gannon from St. Andrews said, If you ever want something, you've got to go up to the Carmelites and pray. And that resonated all the time for me. So I did. I went up to the Carmelite Monastery, which is no more here in Erie, unfortunately for us. But went in, rang the doorbell, or whatever it was, there's a speaker up on the wall and a drum around on the side, and then Archbishop Gannon's picture on the end. The nun came from behind the screen and said, "Praise be Jesus Christ," and I had no idea what to say, so I said, "Hi there." But I told her, I've had some troubles in my life, and I'm working out of town. I've been doing it for 8-10 years, and I'd really like a job back home. She says, "Don't worry about it. Sit back, relax, we'll take care of it." I said, "Too, also, sister, I'd like a business of my own, if that can be arranged." So I left and promised her that I would join them every Saturday morning for Mass. And I did, and then of course my mother came along and my two aunts came along. They loved it too. But it's been a long time on my knees with those girls. Wasn't long before I got a call from the welfare office that I was able to be hired and come in for an interview. So I went in for an interview, and I interviewed with the executive director, not so much the personnel person. And he said, "Well, that's all right, we'll see you in a week or two. Just leave your job and come with us." And I said, "Okay." Waited till Monday. I was working out of Pittsburgh at that time, in Shadyside, I think, and I was doing a store there. So I called the boss and said, "Hey, I've got a job. I'm going to be pulling out here in 2 weeks." And we had the usual conversation there, and I left it at that. The next day, I got a call from the personnel director that says, "You don't have a job. We don't have one. You didn't fit enough, come up high enough on the chart," or whatever that was. So I scurried around and got my job back, kept the company car and all this and that stuff, and just sat back. Well, a week later she called me and said, "Well, you've got the job," and I got Porky and said, "Okay, you send me a registered letter that tells me that, and then I'll quit." To make a long story short, I did end up leaving the drug world. Back. Oh my goodness, how old was I? In my 50s. Those caseworkers have to study like bears. They're awful, and that's what I was supposed to be. I spent every damn lunch hour in the cathedral. Our office was at 10th and Sab, 10th and Peach. And I'd get so nervous and so out of whack that I'd spend my lunch hour in the cathedral. Run quick to pick up a hamburger at McDonald's and get back to work. That first training period was awful. With that maneuver with the nuns, they realized I had a reasonable amount of faith and that I was going to let them do their thing. To me, that was turning things over. And it was real important to me that happened. Took a long time for them to act. Not act, but they were on it right away. But certainly I got the job back home, and then suddenly I get this offer to run the bingo kitchen at St. Andrew's. A few of you have heard that story. And I thought, well, maybe this is the business of my own. Maybe it's going to work into something. So I took the job. I took the thing. And it didn't cost me any money except the inventory. And I paid everybody $10. I was lucky to get $5 at the end of the night. But it worked out. It really did. And I had my whole family there. That was the important thing to me, is that the family was there. My mother baked pies. She was right there. My father poured coffee. Another friend did Mexican Sundays. My mother-in-law did spaghetti. My mother-in-law's aunt, my wife's aunt, did the main dish, and then there were hamburgers and hot dogs, and each one of them had a family member. And my little prayer to those nuns did say, I'd like to have my family happy. I can't afford to have them mad at me. But after a couple of years, at 10 bucks a swat, well, I wasn't doing much. And it was fun. It was grateful for the family, and yet it was time for me to move on. In those sessions with the sisters, which I would stop in every now and then just to say hi and put a $10 bill on their little thing, they got to know me real well, and I got to know them real well. I have a fig tree in my backyard. My one son, my middle son, has enjoyed digging it up, putting it down every fall and spring. Well, they're about to bloom. They are blooming, and they're about to pop. So I'll get dozens of prunes or figs. And at this time of year, Rick would always wait for them, put them in a bag, and take them right up to the nuns. He knew they were vegetarians. They didn't eat much of bread, I guess. But they became part of me and part of my family, really, to get me along. So I kind of use them to as a crutch, if you want to call it that. They bolstered me, and it was a treat on Saturday mornings to go to Mass with them. And they were very pious, religious ladies. The reason they had to leave town, so that you all know, is the Pope says that if there's less than four people in a convent, you have to combine them. And they tried for the last year, I guess, to get nuns from other places. I know they have some in Africa. My sister was there and ran into them. But they couldn't recruit more, so they closed up the convent out there. With their prayers and mine, I did make the list of people that I had offended. And it wasn't reasonably long. And it was a real a revelation, I guess you might call it, to me, of the little things I had done that really I didn't have to do, and I'd piss somebody off. So with that list, not so much in hand, but I started making some amends to these folk. There was a reasonable amount of them. When I look back and see how I ended up before I come in here, shaken like a dog shitting chicken bones. And I had a hell of a time with everything. Red face. One guy, I was working in Florida doing a store down there. And the big shot looked at me and said, your eyes look like piss holes in the snow. I knew what he meant. I just wiped out a bottle. But that's kind of the way I was toward the end. I was in sad shape. So I made the amends that I needed to do. Now comes a part that I really ran across in step 12 in the book. That we temporarily cease to grow, doing fine at just a few steps. The first step and the 12th step. And I think I can remember back to a period where that's kind of all my program was. was admitting I was powerless over alcohol and then carrying a message, and that was a great part of my program, was to carry that message. My sponsor convinced me that I was a power of example, is the term he used. And I had friends that we had done a lot together. The guy I was living with had a boat. A bunch of the other guys had boats, and we were out in the bay and water skiing and all that jazz. But I happened to think when they were talking about the recordings they made, my son probably knows every damn one that's over there because he's been with me all the way. He's been a real bulwark for me. But I did do that two-stepping thing as I look back. I didn't see it then any more than I saw that I was a drunk then. I just knew that I had done something so lackadaisical. And in the 12 and 12, they seem to explain it like it just happens to folks, because you seem to know everything and you don't. All you need is the first step and the 10th, and it gets into you, and you forget about the rest of it until you get someone to work with or something. So that little revelation gave me a boost. I did continue to take personal inventory with the 10th step as I went along. I found that was real redeeming for me to go to bed with a clear mind and be prepared to make amends if I had to. And every now and then that happened. Because the longer I got along in these steps and all the activity of AA, my personality did quite a little change. I grew up, and sincerity was a big part of my life. So was my faith. And that all came from this program that let me do it. AA was the very last thought in my mind. I never thought of it. So, continuing to take personal inventory, I do and did. And it does keep me abreast. I'm sorry myself now that I haven't been really much more active. I should be, and I could be now. I have 2 years behind me that I couldn't be. So I've got to get back on the stick and get into some things. But it's real easy for me to sit back and say the first and the 10th step and go. It's a shame, but that's the truth. I wasn't able to go in the past 2 years, but nonetheless, I kept my program and had my contacts. I still go to the club, although I haven't because of COVID. I was delighted when Kevin asked. No, I wasn't. I was very reluctant when he asked me to do this. But as I come to the end of this, whatever you want to call it, it's been a joy and a real, real uplifter for me. It's putting my program back where it really belongs. And you don't get 47 years by sitting on your butt. You do a few things to keep that alive. So I'm proud of that, but I'm also very grateful for you folks for listening to almost 12 weeks of me. I think my wife has tired of me just running around the house with a paper and a pencil. But I'm glad it's over with. I'm glad I did it. And I can't do anything but thank you.
Thank you, Tom. So this is the time where we open things up for questions and answers. So if you're on Zoom and you have a question, go ahead and unmute yourself and just go ahead and state your question if you're here in the room. Raise your hand and we'll bring you the microphone so that everybody can hear you and the recording can pick you up. So who would like to start us off with a question for Tom? Jim's going to start us off.
Hi, Jim, alcoholic.
Hi, Jim.
Thanks again, Tom, for another great night of AA. And, you know, it tells us in this step that we will have a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Are there any any awakenings or spiritual experiences that stand out to you in particular that are certainly a result of the steps?
Well, I think, first of all, that it wasn't a spiritual experience. It was, when they first said it, what the hell was it? Spiritual. There's a different word they used way back when. Anyhow, yes, there were small periods that I didn't fall over. Holy shit. Yes, as far as many spiritual awakenings, I would say there were a lot there. And usually it developed from me seeing my son get a good grade in school, or my wife accomplishing something with the church. She works for the church. That's where my spirituality seemed to fall together, was that it wasn't so much of a flash out of the air, which I thought I was expecting. But it was more of a subtle, hey, look at this guy. And you did, and you went on. The nuns were the big, big factor for me. I couldn't help but think every move I made, in a particular spiritual move, that someone was up there on Grandview Boulevard kneeling, saying a prayer for me. Because things happened that should be a spiritual awakening, but they were life. And you guys, a long time ago, said you got to watch what you pray for, because you're going to get it. And damned if you don't, you get a bingo kitchen to make $5 a week at. It's what happens. But way, way back, they told me, watch what you pray for, because it's going to happen. Never happens the way you want it or the way you think, but that's kind of the way it happened, Jim, over the time. Just many little experiences that forced me to reflect on how that happened and why it happened, and hit my knees again and say thanks. It's about how it worked out. Okay. Thanks, Jim.
Who else has a question for Tom? Anyone on Zoom?
Hi, Cindy. Not from what I'm...
Hi, Tom.
Oh, hi.
I'm Helen. I'm an alcoholic. I have a question. I've been sober a while, and I've only been on a few actual 12-step calls when we go out to talk to someone who's expressed some interest. I was wondering what your most interesting 12-step call was.
Well, you're flashing a big light on me here. Yeah, I had a real screwy one. I don't know where this girl came from, but she was black. Lived on, I think, 8th and Parade, 7th and Parade, somewhere. And one of the guys that I had met in one of the group called me and said, come over here, she's got a lot of trouble, and so do I. Over I go like a dummy. And I did it alone. I shouldn't do that. But I did. Never thinking that the girl was there. I didn't know that until I got there. And she was a locally known young lady for many, many things. Out she pops from the bedroom with a white lace negligee on. And I had just left home. And, of course, a million thoughts go through your head. But a lot of sense does too at the same time. But I would say that that was the most horrendous 12-step. I would tell you, though, if you get the opportunity, a lot of the 12 steps for me were generated through talking to people. And you have an opportunity here in Erie to talk every 10th night, or every other night, I guess, up at Mill Creek Community Hospital. I think they still have the 6 o'clock meeting where you go up there and you just talk to the folks. That's how I got started. That was to our north, though, back then, on the second floor of St. Vincent's. I went with Jack Side. That's why I got involved in it. But I really think in your own, if you're looking hard just to have peace of mind, you don't have to pick up a 12-step, but just the peace of mind that that gives you for giving the program away, I don't know if you can pay for that. It's a wonderful, wonderful feeling. And somewhere along the line, you're going to hit somebody that, that says, oh, I remember that girl or that guy. And the contact has been made. My disease crept right up on me. And I don't know what single point or individual turned that knob for me, but somebody did, because it didn't take me long to get to the fellowship. So I wish you luck on your 12-step adventure, but really try it. Just call up there and ask if there's a if you can fit in on a 6 o'clock meeting. I think it's still 6. It was 6 before. I don't know why it would change. But good luck. Oh, for goodness sakes.
Oh, for goodness sakes. I'm always going to be here. I'm not getting out that early. Anyway, thank you again for coming and doing this. I know it's a big ask when I do it. And most of the time I pull the wool over people's eyes. So, again, thank you for doing this. I know that you appreciate it afterwards. Everybody appreciates it afterwards. I have a couple of questions. Since this is a legacy meeting and you got sober in 1974, look around, and we're all pretty young in 1974. So, first thing, you know, you talked about Bob being your first sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
Bob's not around anymore.
No,
is he?
No.
So what was Bob's last name?
That was it, Tommy. Nesbitt.
Okay.
Nesbitt, yeah.
Okay. So just, you know, so when we listen to this in retrospect, we know some of the names of the people that, you know, in 1974, you were beginning your own journey on this. But who was, like, say, the long-timers then?
Gene Acree. Bob. Oh, there's a bunch of them.
I mean, we don't have to worry about breaking her anonymity.
No, right? I don't. I know that, but I have to break it, figure out who the hell it was.
Okay.
Because there was a flock of them, Six Pack Charlie, and back then they seemed to all have their seats in the club. Huh. You'd go in there at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, where Six Pack would be back in the corner talking to somebody. Gene would be over here, or somebody would stop at the butcher shop and talk to Gene. The congeniality was quite nice. As I mentioned, Gene, why a bunch of us got together. I didn't have a boat, but a bunch of the fellas had a boat. We met out at Beach 11, and I brought macaroni, or somebody brought something else. And Gene provided steaks. Mm-hmm. Not provided, we bought them from him, but he hung them up so they'd get aged a little bit. And it was just the way the whole facet worked. At that time, Carol King and her husband Kenny, well, she wasn't married to Kenny at that point, but she had a cottage down on Ferncliff. In fact, they just sold it, I think. But that was kind of a gathering spot for all of us. And Brad Swanson lived right next door. He was very active here. But we had such a great, great time. It's a shame I'm forgetting an awful lot of people, because there was a ton of them that held this all together at that time and did a lot for all of us. So I suppose if I sat on my butt and thought about it, I'd get you a couple more names, but right now I'm not going to.
Okay. Well, that's good. Just for posterity's sake, it was just nice to hear the names of the people who, you know, carried their message to you, and you carried your message to us.
And they carried it with a lot of sincerity. They didn't fool around. Does anybody remember Bush Pius?
Yes.
Yeah. Gene was his sponsor.
Okay.
First thing Gene said when he met Butch, he says, "This guy's going to be trouble." And he was. But he was a great guy. Well, we did a lot of things together, and they were sober things. Went up to a ball game or something. You know, it wasn't anything big, but it kept us all sober and kept us conversing in sober, if you want to use that for language. Why? It was a constant companion for conversation. So it was great. Still is.
So is there anything that you would suggest to us today that we carry that message forward from the long-timers to the newcomers?
Well, first of all, to be an old-timer, you only have to have, I think, 10 years and go to Buzz Green's picnic, if you ever went to that. He does that once a year out of his play. But I really think the best thing someone can do is get involved with something similar to LECOMS, their meetings, or Central Committee. I don't know if you've been to many meetings, but how many meetings have you heard them say, "We're going to send $100 to Central Committee, $50 to the telephone thing"? They don't, and they should. A lot of these meetings have a lot of money, and that's nice, but it's there for people to use. Send it to New York, they print another book. All those things. So attending their meetings, a Central Committee meeting, to me would be a great way to get to know the different people of the program. They're going to be a little bit different than you and I, but very sincere in what they do. And they hold it all together, really. And then there's meetings that are statewide. And then, of course, conferences. A lot of them get together for a last conference. I heard it was up in Canada somewhere. But a lot of folks will do that. Take couples and go to conferences. So there's lots of ways to get active. And I don't know if you want to wait for 30 years to get this active, but it has really been a joy when I think back. It's one of those thanks I needed, that guys. And it really is. It's great. Thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Tom. We have a couple of